This is a CBC podcast. Hey, kids, enter the TD Kids Book Club contest, and you could win a visit to your school from one of the TD Canadian Children's Literature Award nominees. And CBC Radio will be there to put it on the air. Visit cbc.ca/kidsbookclub for details. Contest only in selected cities.
Welcome to the podcast of CBC Radio's Dispatches for September 24th, 2009. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. This week, the new prisoners of piracy. Why monsoon season is the only safe haven for crews of the small boats that sail the Indian Ocean. We'll hear from the Canadian in charge of the count in Afghanistan's tainted election. Then, Pulitzer Prize winner Tracy Kidder with a story of triumph over memory of the massacres in Burundi. Then it's the Ramadan blogs. Two American-raised Muslims get an eye-opener when they venture into the mosques of other cultures in New York. And from a high plateau in Mali, a trio of Canadians bring healing hands to people who've never seen medical care. This is Dispatches. And welcome to the program. Piracy and hostage taking on the Indian Ocean are expensive new costs of doing business for the world's major shipping companies. But now, it's also hitting the little guys. Sailors from coastal India who crew even the smallest sailing boats have become targets. Now, most are at home on shore right now, taking advantage of the current rainy season to get rested, and in some cases, to get married, as we hear from Anna Cunningham.
A child leads two horses, decorated in tinsel and bells, to the door of a small house, strewn with flowers and decorations. Neighbours and families crowd into the narrow alleyway to watch as two young grooms are hoisted onto the horses, their faces covered in a veil of tinsel. The onlookers follow as the grooms are led slowly through the village to meet their brides. This is wedding season in the coastal village of Salaya. Outside the local mosque, the village imam prepares for yet another wedding. During monsoon season, there are 6 to 10 marriages a day.
When the ship sails back to Salaya, it's happy time, as this is the only time that the boys are here. There is happiness in the streets and homes. The men bring back money and gifts, so there is shopping and the streets come alive with sounds.
The celebrations seep in the window of this small house where a young woman sits on her bed, holding her younger sister's hand. Rashida is 20, but could pass for 15. A year ago, she was the bride, wearing a bright red sari on her wedding day. The celebrations lasted 3 days, and the family feasted on mutton and biryani. But as for the couples getting married today, it was a bittersweet time for Rashida.
When we got married, there were happy and sad moments at the same time. I knew that he was going to see and would leave me for 10 long months.
As wedding processions weave their way past the hundreds of boats moored up on the shore, builders pause from their repairs to watch. The small wooden cargo boats called dhows have been built here for generations, says Abdul Karim, a local boat owner. The ships sail out to the Gulf of Aden, trading between India, Gulf and East African countries.
Since from forefathers' time we are using this type of business, and we are each and everybody are involved in this business. Our life is involved in this business. Our children, our relatives, all people are involved in this business.
And while the tradition has always been that the women wait and hope that their husbands return home safely, those prayers for a safe journey have taken on a new urgency. The waters the men sail have become a playground for Somali pirates, and the dhows are easy prey. As he prepares to commission another dhow for the upcoming season, Abdul knows he has no choice but to send the men towards possible peril.
We are not getting business in India, that is why we are going there. Otherwise, why should we go? Why should we go there outside of the area, in dangerous area, where they are doing piracy and they are shooting us, fighting us and kidnapping us? We don't want to go there.
The Somali pirates are usually armed with guns or knives. They hijack the dhows to sail undetected towards their real target, larger ships such as oil tankers, which they hold ransom for millions of dollars. It was into those dangerous waters that Rashida's new husband Imran set sail last September. The new bride lived in her family's home while she waited for Imran to return. Today, she and her sister make dinner in the small kitchen. The first 7 months on her own passed slowly, but with only 3 months left before he was to return, news came. It was not good. Imran's boat was lost.
We only got the news that our boat was lost. I was frightened a lot.
And her fears were justified. Imran's boat, the Sharm Shah Medina, had been hijacked by pirates.
I went with my family to meet religious leaders and we kept on praying to the Almighty God. When he was caught, I was frightened. Where he might have been, how he was surviving, and what trouble he's going through.
The days dragged into a week with no word. She was not the only one waiting.
Whole village, peoples, the family members of the crewmen, the owner's family, they don't know now our vessel will be released or not, our people will come back or not, because they have history to kill all the crew members and hijacks. And
a short walk from Rashida's family home is the offices of Salaya's Sailing Vessels Owners Association. Adam Haroon Baya is the association's secretary. His walls are covered with maps, lined with routes across the sea to and from Salaya. When one of the boats goes off course or disappears, it falls to Adam to deliver the bad news to families like Rashida's.
Each trip, we don't know that our vessel is departure from this port to next port, whether she will be rich or not.
He's leafing through piles of paperwork, reports of ships lost, recordings of hijackings. Adam knows the risks the sailors take.
Because every year I knew 4 or 5 sailing vessels maybe sank, 2 or 3 vessels burnt out, and 1 or 2 vessels every year hijacked by the Somalian people.
Back at the house, Rashida tells me that she was one of the lucky wives. When news finally arrived about Imran, it was good.
I went to my neighbours and everyone I knew shouting that my husband's coming back. At last, he's coming back.
And when he reached shore, when he got home, what was the first thing you said to him? Do you remember? Did you tell him you loved him?
She nods shyly and smiles. I find 24-year-old Imran checking repairs on the dhow, readying the boat to sail again once monsoon ends. Outside of his wife's earshot, he tells me what happened the last time he left this shore.
We left the cargo in Mogadishu and were on our way back. After 2 days at sea, 3 speedboats of Somalis came and ordered us to stop. They had rocket launchers, hand grenades and firearms. We stopped the engine and they came on board. They took control and told us they wanted to find an oil tanker or a container ship and forced us to sail, threatening us. After travelling 600 nautical miles, we reached near a big container ship, but they weren't able to capture it.
They knew what happened next would determine whether they would see their wives or families again.
We travelled another 24 hours, then they abandoned us. It was really tough and frightening for all of us. We were thinking about home. We weren't able to send any messages. They took away our SSB radio. There was no communication at all. When they finally left us, there was joy on the ship. All of us were really happy and celebrating.
Imran and his brother play a video game, shooting enemies on the computer.
It's a very good game.
As the family gathers at home for a meal, it's hard to imagine the drama of last spring ever existed. But Imran admits the hijacking and its impact on Rashida is never far from his mind.
My wife is very beautiful. I care about her a lot. It is very difficult to describe my emotions. When I was captured by the Somalis, she worried a lot. When I came back, she shared those moments with me. It was really terrifying when I was unsure if I would ever return. At the time that we were captured by the Somalis, the first thing that came to my mind was, no, I'm not going to go to sea again. This is my last trip. It's not only us, but for all the ships that sail through that area. It's dangerous, so the risk is always looming over us. I don't want to go back, but there's no option because the business is there.
Outside the house, another wedding parade passes by. Rashida watches and pulls her headscarf across her face. She knows Imran will soon be leaving.
I wish he'd never go back, but I know this is the only source of income for us. While my husband was on the ship, my elder brother-in-law fell sick. We spent a lot of money for his hospital treatment, so we're now facing a financial crisis, so he has to go back to sea. I have to be very practical about this. I'm afraid, but I have to let him go. And it's not only my husband, but my father-in-law is also going with him to sea. I have to be strong, but I have to send him.
There are fewer weddings now, and the monsoon rains are beginning to leave India. Soon the churning seas will be calm enough for the patched-up dhows along the shore to set sail again. For Dispatches, I'm Anna Cunningham in Salaya, India.
And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada, and you're listening to the podcast version of CBC Radio's Dispatches. It's available every Thursday about midday at cbc.ca/podcasting, where you'll find hundreds of hours of the CBC's best programs. Coming up, how the Feast of Ramadan turned into a feast of funk for two adventurous American Muslims. But first, the investigation into vote rigging in the Afghan election has been fast-tracked by the UN. Instead of examining every single box and ballot, its Election Complaints Commission, the ECC, will look instead only at representative samples. Now that's sure to keep the matter politically charged in a way that won't please everybody. There are reportedly enough votes under review that a finding of massive fraud could well overturn the election of President Hamid Karzai and force a runoff. A finding in his favor, on the other hand, risks disappointing his challenger, who's already warned there's no telling how his supporters will react to another disappointment. And supervising this whole delicate business is a Canadian, Grant Kippen, chair of the Election Complaints Commission, and he joins me from Kabul. Mr. Kippen, welcome to Dispatches.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Now, Mr. Kippen, you seem to be sitting on a tinderbox. Everyone awaits your findings. Some are certain to be offended in a country that works out its resentments with AK-47s. What are the stakes, the tensions, as you see them, that you know to be turning on your work?
I think we recognize that there are going to be people that look to our decisions and support them, and there's going to be other people that obviously will disagree with the decisions we take, but we're committed to making informed decisions, and in the decisions that we make, they will be made public, and so people can see the information, how we've gone about making our decisions, and whether they agree or disagree with us. I think our objective is to make sure that they understand how we made our decisions. So in terms of the larger issues that are out there, we can't really spend much time thinking about. We just have our job to do, and that's what we're focusing on.
You've never given any thought to the consequences of what might happen, both if people agree or disagree with what you find out?
I get the sense that through the public outreach, through the media that we've been doing over the past number of months, that people have come to understand, maybe not quite accept, but certainly have a much better understanding of our role in the process.
Now, you've decided to sample the disputed ballots and disputed boxes now rather than go through the longer process of examining every one. Where does that come from? Why the shift in position now, nearly a month after the election?
Well, I don't think it's a shift in position. We're simply looking at the an efficient and way of undertaking this process. And I think we also have to be mindful that if there is a requirement for a second round, which is yet to be determined, that we allow sufficient time in the process to actually have that happen. So we're simply trying to get through this in a timely manner, but also a thorough and professional manner. This kind of approach using samples, etc., has been done in other countries, and it's something we feel comfortable with.
Have the presidential candidates, Mr. Karzai and Mr. Abdullah, indicated they're comfortable with it too?
No, as far as I'm aware, they haven't indicated anything at all. What's happening right now is that the IEC is working through a lot of the details in terms of what's the size of the sample, where is that sample going to be drawn from, whether the teams that will be doing the audit and the recount will actually go out to the provincial warehouses where these ballot boxes are located, or whether they will be brought here to Kabul.
Now, somebody, it seems, has gone to a lot of trouble to try and interfere with the outcome of this election, and I'm wondering why they would stop now. How confident are you that nobody can interfere with the samples or has in the meantime?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that's all part of the details that are being currently worked out right now. I think we have to be cognizant of this potential, but I think we just have to wait and see how it's implemented.
Is it your expectation then that this sampling will allow for a much quicker count?
I think that's one of the advantages of going down this route. That if it's depending on the sample size, it could be undertaken much quicker than all 3,063 polling stations that would make up the total universe of the that comes underneath our order.
Is that to make possible a runoff if it's warranted, or why else would you do it?
Well, I mean, the reason we issued the order was to try to get to the bottom of whether fraud has actually been committed in certain polling stations, and that's what this audit and recount will do. And that may or may not necessitate a second round. I think what we're hoping to do is get this completed in time so that if a second round is required, then the ECC, the IEC, will be able to undertake a second round election so that winner doesn't impact on that second round.
In hindsight, Mr. Kippen, how do you view the UN's decision not to run the elections as in 2004 when you were there, but giving the job to the Afghan-run Independent Election Commission, which was perceived at least as beholden to Mr. Karzai, who appointed its members? In hindsight, was that a good idea?
Well, I think it's important as this democratic process gets rolled out that institutions are put in place, Afghan institutions are put in place that take ownership and responsibility for this, for elections and in support of those elections. And if not now, when, is part of the question. So I think the IEC, certainly our dealings with the IEC have been very professional, very collaborative all the way along. These institutions are going to take time to develop, and I think the sooner that this starts to happen, the better it will be for Afghan ownership and responsibility for the overall process.
I recall after you chaired the same election complaints commission there 4 years ago and had to disqualify a candidate in the presidential election, there were crowds outside protesting your decision, some shouting, "Death to Kippen." Are you having to take any particular security measures now to allow for that kind of dissatisfaction?
I'd rather not get into the specifics of the security arrangements, but security is an issue for everyone in the commission, and it's first and foremost in our minds.
Candidates there still run as individuals rather than party members, and I wonder, Do you suppose the success of democracy turns on how well political parties can evolve in Afghanistan, and does the present system hold that back?
I think over time, political parties will need to take more of a mainstream role in the politics here, and that's all part of the democratic transition that's occurring here.
I recall you telling the House of Commons once in a brief to the Foreign Affairs Committee that the world needed more Canadian leadership in democratic development there. How did you put it? We need to pester, nag, and bite, as Churchill once is alleged to have put it. How well are we pestering, nagging, and biting, we Canadians, to bring about democratic development in Afghanistan?
You know, from a personal level, I think that's something we need to keep pushing for, and so that we're able to, as you put it, pester, nag, and bite in this area around the world. And it's something that we can work with other countries and other systems that need some support. And I think we're headed in the right direction. I would like to see it happen quicker.
Well, Mr. Kippen, best of luck in the delicate job you have ahead. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Grant Kippen is the chair of the UN-backed Election Complaints Commission in Afghanistan, and he is in Kabul. If any of our stories remind you of one of yours, put it into a mini-dispatch and email it to the program. The address is dispatches@cbc.ca. I'll see about reading it on the air. Now, two Muslims living in New York City recently came up with what they call an insanely random idea. What if they prayed at a different mosque every single night of Ramadan, Islam's month-long period of prayer and fasting? Why? Why not? And so a website was born. And with some trepidation, the American-raised pair headed out to the masjids, as they're known in Arabic, of many different cultures. Here's some excerpts from their blog, read by the site's authors, Aman Ali and Bassam Tariq.
In Brooklyn, go east on Ralph Avenue and you'll see two mosques, the Bangladeshi joint and the West African one, or as the sign tells me, Masjid Tawheed. My good friend Ibrahim pressed me hard this afternoon to go to the West African mosque. I passed by the Bangladeshi one first, and to be honest, wanted to go there instead. I had a long day at work, and my fast wasn't going so well. The last thing I wanted was to be out of my element. But this project isn't about me eating samosas and curry chicken with my fellow South Asian folk. It's about breaking out of this brown bubble I've surrounded myself in. So I enter Masjid Tawheed and see a large line for wudu, the ritual washing before prayer, that trailed into the prayer area, and all eyes were on me. During iftar, the breaking of the fast, we had dates and a sweet oatmeal dish. I looked around and realized I was the only South Asian there. Everyone else was either from Mali, Burkina Faso, or Guinea. As I grabbed some soup, they waited for me to take a sip. "So how do you like it?" a man asked. It was a little heavy for me, but I didn't want to disrespect the congregant's taste, so I tried my best to finish as much as I could. Dinner was a Malian dish called hutto, couscous with ground meat, minced with spinach and peanuts. Many of the congregants offered me some, but I was full and politely declined. I felt like a freeloader coming in, barely eating the food offered to me, and then leaving abruptly right after. Maybe it's my own insecurities, but I wondered if anyone asked themselves, why didn't you just go to the Bangladeshi mosque?
Today began with two bits of bad news. I woke up, looked outside my apartment window, and saw that my car had been towed. And then, Bassam emailed me saying a mosque in the Bronx had burned down last night. The Islamic Cultural Center is a mosque still healing from a terrible tragedy 2 years ago when 10 people from this congregation, 9 of them children, died in a horrific house fire. By fate, the towing pound I was picking up my car from was only a mile or two away from the mosque. So I decided to break my fast there. And right away, I noticed the scorch marks on the roof from the night before. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. A man named Bilal tapped me on my shoulder, pointing me to the temporary mosque, 2 blocks away inside an empty storefront. We broke our fast with some dates and prayed in another barren room that only had blue tarp on the floor. After prayer, I began thinking about how insignificant the problems in my own life are. I mean, less than an hour ago, I was whining about some stupid tow truck. My eyes teared just thinking about it. Bilal must have noticed as he was putting on his shoes, since he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Come, we are all brothers." Bilal took me into the room next door where everyone was eating dinner. There was seasoned steak, beef stew, plantains, and salad. Bilal brought up one of my favorite sayings from Prophet Muhammad, that the Muslim community is like a body. And when one part of the body is in pain, the entire body is in pain. And when one of us suffers, we all feel that pain. But Bilal said this saying also applies to happiness. So when one of us is feeling good, he said the rest of us should feel the same. But I'll never forget what Bilal said next. He said, "My wife tonight made the best steak you'll ever taste in your entire life. Now, you really have no reason to be sad." He was right.
I've been looking for this elusive Bosnian mosque in Queens for quite a while. And earlier today, I found myself at the Bosnian Islamic Center. I took off my backpack and sat in an empty corner inside. The congregants seemed to know one another pretty well, as both men and women roam the prayer area freely. Soon enough, my friend Omer calls to inform me that I'm sitting in the wrong Bosnian mosque. Turns out the center I was looking for is half a mile north. Just when the congregants and I started warming up to one another, I smile and walk out. As I exit the center, I asked one of the volunteers where the other Bosnian mosque was. He gave me the directions and then asked, "Can I see your ID?" I laughed, thinking he was joking. "Did you not hear me? Can I see your ID?" I was a little shocked at first, but nevertheless showed him my ID. By this time, a small crowd formed around us. I pointed out the name on my Texas driver's license, Bassam Muhammad Tariq. "Satisfied," he says. "Sorry, I hope you don't mind. We're a small community, and we've already had an incident with the FBI. I'm just looking out for my congregation." In this post-9/11 world, I understood where they were coming from. I gave my salams and headed north to the other Bosnian mosque. The difference between the first Bosnian center and the one I just entered were striking. Just during iftar, there was a Turkish man sitting in front of me, an Egyptian man to my left, and Mahin, my Bangladeshi buddy, to my right. Turns out the reasons why I had such a hard time finding this mosque is because I was Googling Bosnian mosque, when clearly, the space was so much more than that. After all, the mosque is called the Islamic Unity and Cultural Center.
Eid is without a doubt one of my favorite times of the year. It's the feast to celebrate the end of Ramadan. It's a day that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that was a day for all of us to rejoice. I was eager to revisit Masjid Khalifa in Brooklyn after hearing about how the mosque celebrates Eid. The mosque was established in the late 1950s, after Malcolm X and his Nation of Islam congregants spotted a dance club and thought it would be an ideal place for a temple. Eventually, the congregation broke away from the Nation of Islam and followed mainstream Islam. I met up with my friend Sharif and we rolled through Masjid Khalifa around 6 p.m. Michael Jackson music was blasting through the entire building, and across the room, there were little kids doing the MJ kick and moonwalks. We sat down to eat in the community hall. Tonight on the menu, beef tips, barbecue chicken, baked chicken, lamb, goat, and catfish. And for sides, I had corn, lentil rice, and spinach. Then a band took the stage and started off with some funk instrumentals to warm the crowd up. Then, three African-American Muslim women took the stage to lead the crowd in one of my favorite songs, "Stop in the Name of Love." The crowd went nuts. The singers were walking up and down the aisles trying to get the audience hyped. Then, a woman in black niqab got up and started busting out moves that I didn't even think were humanly possible. Sharif and I looked at each other, realizing not a single one of our friends would believe what we'd just witnessed. In just about every mosque I've been to, the celebration that Masjid Khalifa had tonight would never fly. But then I started thinking, why not? What's wrong with cranking out a few tunes for people to enjoy on one of the most special days of the year to celebrate? To see Muslims spend the day of Eid with their friends and family completely energized from head to toe is a sight I haven't seen in such a long time. After the celebration, we all helped clean up. I carried some tables to a nearby wall. One of the elderly gentlemen saw me and shouted at me not to move the tables. That's when one of the women I'd met earlier said, "You've prayed with us, had food with us, and now you've been yelled at for doing something wrong. Congratulations, you're officially a member of this masjid."
And that's Iman Ali, and before him, Bassam Tariq, in New York City, giving voice to their blog called 30 Mosques. And there's a link to it on our website, cbc.ca/dispatches. And you can tell us about your Ramadan adventures or comment on anything you hear on the program. Just email dispatches@cbc.ca. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada, and you're listening to the podcast version of Dispatches. Now, in the 90s, the genocide in Rwanda got the headlines, but neighboring Burundi suffered much the same fate as it had many times before. And fleeing its violence, a young medical student named Deo made his way past the assassins, eventually arriving in New York City. He slept in Central Park, worked the worst jobs, and wrestled with the memory of the slaughter he'd seen. Eventually, though, he was adopted by a series of Samaritans who even saw him through medical school, and eventually he built his own clinic back in Burundi, one he views now as an oasis of ethnic tranquility. Deo's story is told in the new book Strength in What Remains by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder, a master of narrative nonfiction. He's a lean and youthful-looking 64 with these large, gnarled fingers and laugh lines that jump out when he gets excited, and he is excited about this story. Tracy Kidder joins me in studio to talk about it. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
For this story to become possible, Deo had to cheat death, it seems, time and time again, overcome daunting odds. Can you tell me about the first time he had to do it, though, as he lay on the floor, peering out from under that bed?
He was a third-year medical student, at the end of the third year, working as sort of as an intern at a large but rather remote hospital in, deep in the countryside. The day before, the first elected president of Burundi had been murdered, been assassinated. And on that morning, all hell broke loose. Quite literally, a group of men, barefoot men, with machetes and other weapons, arrived at the hospital and started killing people. And Deo ran to his room, as many others did, crawled under his bed, and then realized he had forgotten to close his door. He saw, shortly after that, a couple of bare feet appear in his doorway, and he heard these men say, "The cockroach is gone." He ran away. And so they didn't come in and check under the bed. And so in, he left his door open and death passed him by. Others who closed their doors, of course, he could hear the doors being smashed in and the windows being smashed into other rooms. It was, and he waited until it was all over, until the darkness fell, and then he waded out through corpses and crossed the road and down into a river valley, and then for the next 6 months he was really on foot.
Would you sketch out the context of those times a little bit more? The Rwandan genocide is perhaps better known, but Burundi was in the throes of its own terror in 1993. What was going on in a larger political sense around Deo at that time?
Burundi is like, you know, sort of like the fraternal twin of Rwanda, very alike but very different in consequential ways. In Burundi, a small group of Tutsis had been in charge, three successive dictators all coup d'etat-ing each other. They were Tutsis. To stay in power in Burundi, there had been they had committed a horrible, what was often called a selective genocide in 1972. So on Hutus, killing all the Hutus that they thought might be a threat to their power at some point. When finally, under international pressure, the unelected government agreed to elections, and then the Hutu had been elected, a man of peace by all accounts, and then was assassinated by a faction of people in the Tutsi army, there was enormous anger among Hutus. So a slaughter of a fairly indiscriminate slaughter, like the one that Deo listened to around, you know, and narrowly escaped. There were a fair number of those, and then there was the Tutsi army's retaliation, and then civil war, sort of rising and falling intensity for 13 years, depending on how you date the end of it. But in any case, it was fairly recent, the end.
For people like Deo, then, it meant escaping assassins and illness and hunger. But for him, not the memories so much, not the images he came across on his cross-country flight. Could you tell me about the one that seems to haunt him often? I'm thinking about
the woman with the baby.
The child at the mother's breast.
For some period of time, he was running on foot to the north through this national forest, Kibera, heading toward Rwanda. And he ended up utterly exhausted, feeling pretty sick, and found himself in a banana grove. There were corpses all around, and he didn't care anymore. He just sort of sat down with his back against a banana tree, a little clump of banana trees, and looked. Then he looked, and he saw a woman leaning against a clump of banana trees, and she was clearly dead, but there was a baby who was sort of trying to get at her breast. And the baby was alive, and he remembers the baby looking at him, as if, you know, saying, you know, sort of asking for help. And he remembers thinking, you know, I can't help that baby. I can't. There's nothing I can do. And getting up and sort of staggering away and sitting, finding another clump of banana trees to lie against. And so, I mean, you couldn't blame him for this. But there really wasn't anything he could do. But that doesn't get him off the hook for him, you know, for himself. And I think it haunts him, yeah, like a lot of stuff.
There's a time when you're sitting by a lake having lunch and you refer to the fact, I don't know what it was to get to that place beyond horror, because he's present with you, but then he's suddenly absent.
Yeah. Yeah,
he goes off in his own head, in his own mind, then as now.
Sometimes, yes. Yes, he does.
I mean, there are times when he's actually quite mad?
Well, I don't think he was mad. I do believe that one can go some distance toward imaginatively entering another person's shoes, so to speak. But I think it's one of the ways he hangs on to his sanity. He's a very sane guy. He just has this burden of ungovernable memories that, you know, he has to carry.
You presented in narrative nonfiction an approach in your writing you're quite famous for, and I just wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that. What it allows you to do that another form that would not?
For me, it's always the first thing I've always looked for is a character. I think of myself as a storyteller, if I'm anything, and I think the essence of storytelling is, of course, human character. So over all my writing career, that's what I've looked for, is interesting people. And then, of course, I get interested in what it preoccupies them. In Deo's case, this is public health and medicine and the terrible state of his country after war. But what drew me to this first, when I first heard this story from Deo, it was a little thing that really got me. And he was talking about how when he was homeless in New York City, before he'd go to bed in Central Park, he would look all around to make sure no strangers were watching. And because anyone who saw him going to the park at that hour would know that he was homeless, and this would have been humiliating. And I'm sure that in other kinds of situations I felt the same way, caring, not worrying so much about the darkness in the park or about what might happen to me if I surrendered to sleep there, but the pity or disdain of strangers who would always be strangers to me. It's an odd thing, at least in some people's psyches. Maybe not yours.
Leave me with some dignity.
Yeah, yeah. And it was something about just that one little detail that made me think I could maybe find a way into this story.
Well, you certainly did. And when you describe him sleeping in Central Park and eventually finding help from some unbidden Samaritans, the story takes a very interesting gear change. Talk to me about some of those people who lived their lives on that selfless plane and intervened to change Israel profoundly.
Well, the first one was this ex-contemplative nun who was works up at a Upper East Side Catholic church. And Deo was delivering groceries at that point for $15 a day, 12 hours of work. He was feeling pretty bad by this time. I mean, you know, all his dreams were ashes, and he was feeling ill. And he came in, and there was this woman, and she spoke a bit of French. And to make a kind of long story short, she just took him on, sometimes infuriating him. I mean, you know, I don't think he knew the half of what she tried to do for him, but she basically was looking for a family for him, and she found one. She found this childless couple, a painter and a sociologist, neither young nor rich, who had an interest in Africa, had spent quite a bit of time in Nigeria, a kind of adventurous couple. And they hesitated, of course, anyone would. But they took him. And they put him through the rigorous ESL program at Columbia University, and then helped in part to pay his tuition to Columbia University. So 2 years after landing in New York this way, he's a student at an Ivy League university. It's pretty amazing.
And that he becomes a medical professional, having arrived with so little, is even more amazing.
What's really amazing to me, if I say so, is that he went, here he is, he became an American citizen, he was working for Partners in Health, he was on his way back to medical school, and he decided that he had to go home to Burundi and build this clinic and public health system in a rural village, and a thing called Village Health Works, which is just, it's a marvel, actually. I mean, it is a country that really needs all the help it can possibly get. And this is not a political act. He doesn't have any ambitions along those lines. It's just, and the thing is thriving. He has a sort of a charismatic way about him. He has rallied an enormous number of American friends, and they've raised quite a lot of money.
Knowing what you know now about Burundi and having seen it through Deo's eyes and your own, do you have any more confidence in its stability and its security after this history of massacre that it maybe isn't going to be a certain thing again?
I think that the proper term for it is fragile. But I also hold with Graham Greene that no one can foretell the future with any certainty. My sense, and this isn't from my own research, since mine was hardly extensive, but I read a very good book by a scholar named Peter Uven, who really went back and interviewed people after the war. And my sense from that book is that most people feel as Deo does, is they're sick of war. And they're not, they don't care so much about these ethnic differences, which by the way, you know, historically were never quite as severe as in Rwanda, pre-colonization in any case, because it was a more complicated and a little more fluid society. But of course, there are any number of ways in which a country that's desperately poor can fall again into, you know, mass violence. It's and I don't have any of the answers for that.
Unless we leave people thinking this is a pessimistic story, this is a story about memory, about, as you said, that lovely line, the ungovernable quality of Deo's memories. Although I thought him harsh when he said at one point, remembering is not going to benefit anyone.
Uh-huh.
Still, it's his preference to act on memory rather than to dwell on it, I think, right, that gives it an optimistic edge. And ultimately, he's done that through his medical clinic?
Yeah, I believe so. As a young man in high school, he had dreamed of building a clinic to serve the kinds of people he'd grown up among. And he failed. But I sort of see this as a welding back together of his life. And the hope is that this little instrument of peace could spread, you know. What's beautiful to me about this is that here's this horrible violence that went on there for a long, long time that was based on largely artificial differences among two groups of people, differences that were exaggerated for the advantage of a few. And here you have an antidote or a potential antidote or a little beginning of an antidote that's based on something that unites us all, which is our common vulnerability to illness and injury. Our hope, our common hope for life, you know. What's very moving to me is the enormous support that this clinic and public health system has in the region where it's situated. I mean, people just bust their tails working there as volunteers, and they, you know, they just love this thing.
Well, it is a book about tragedy, but it is also a book about uncommon hope. Thank you for talking about it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Tracy Kidder's new book is called Strength in What Remains, and it's published by Random House. Now, here's something you may not know. 11 years ago, one of the poorest countries in the world came to Canada's aid. That was the year of the ice storm, and a small group of people in the African state of Mali raised $65 for the relief effort in rural Quebec. Call it payback. Some years earlier, Canadians had sent help to them after a bad flood in Mali. Well, all these years later, Dispatches contributor Alexa Dvorsen went trekking among the Dogon people of Mali's remote Banjagara escarpment. And you know what? She found the wheel has turned again.
You know you've arrived in the Dogon country when you hear people greet each other like this. This salutation can last anywhere from 5 seconds to 5 minutes, depending on how many members of the other person's extended family you ask about, or if you're off to the market.
It's another market day, this time in the village of Tereli. And the colors are just staggering in the late afternoon sun.
Women are wearing beautiful indigo cloth that's also colored yellow. There's everything here for sale one could possibly imagine, from flashlights and bonbons to dried fish from the River Niger, flip-flops, vegetables, dates, onion balls, jewelry. But the liveliest place seems to be where women are pouring millet beer. And I'm going to see if I can get a little closer to hear what they're saying.
The dark, sudsy broth sloshing around in a big hollowed-out gourd takes a week to make. But right now, it's about to soak my microphone. Madina, who brews it at home, turns a modest profit when she sells it for a penny a liter. Apelenu Sai, a Dogon guide, drinks it with gusto when he's on the trails and back roads that connect all these Dogon villages.
Tili, Walia, Ende, Yabatalu, Dunjuru, Endelu.
Sandstone cliffs jut silently into a fierce blue sky. And every now and then, the miles of amber-toned sand give way to emerald fields of green onions. It's hard to say why this landscape makes me so joyous. But when children take turns holding my hands to escort me through a village, the reason doesn't matter. It's enough to sense that all is well in their world. Just to walk this terrain and be greeted by everyone crossing my path delivers a peace so palpable that the rest of the world tends to melt away. And when the blistering heat is about to melt me away, a bit of shade hits the spot. Then my bliss comes in hot sips from small glasses. Not millet beer, though.
Foamy, thick, green, sweet Chinese tea. I can never keep track of all the pouring of the foam back and forth between the glasses, back into the pot, back onto the fire, rinse off the glasses without losing the foam. It must be something like that, but I don't know how they do it. That was worth the 2-hour wait.
Rest stops like this are good for storytelling. That's when Apelenu's cousin, Batru Sai, who runs a guide business, explains that the Dogon word for tourist actually means something quite different. Because when Westerners first started trekking around here, the Dogon weren't sure what to make of them.
Nous, on dit que même dans la langue Dogon, on dit pas touriste, on dit anasara, les gens qui n'ont pas de domicile.
In the Dogon language, they didn't call them tourists, Batru says. They called them anasara, which means people without a home. The Dogon thought trekkers were just people who traveled around all the time, without a job or any place to live. To those who live so close to the land, it's no wonder we look like drifters. There's never been much news of the outside world around here. Even the radio sounds like it's being broadcast from a distant planet. And so I've drifted back to Benyamato, an ancient settlement perched on top of one of these honey-colored cliffs. The view is sublime, a vast expanse of scorching Sahelian plain, with baobab, tamarind, and fragrant neem trees dwarfed in the distance. I didn't just come for the scenery, though. I came looking for Yirgima, a village elder whose friendly eyes and crinkly smile burned into my memory when I first met him here 7 years ago. But before I have a chance to ask about him, I hear a voice that turns my perception of Dogon life inside out.
Could you guys just move back, please? Move back, move back. Can we move back, please?
Standing like an apparition, a friendly-looking anasara, a Westerner in khaki shorts and a matching T-shirt, is doing some crowd control in front of a colorful piece of cotton flapping in the wind.
We will get to everybody.
Behind this flimsy curtain, sheltered in the shade, two women, a doctor and a nurse, are giving medical treatment to villagers who have never been to a physician before.
We have lots of time, okay?
How many of these people are actually needing treatment, do you think? I counted about 30 or 40 out here.
Maybe half of them actually need treatment. A lot of them, too, are just children who are curious. So we've probably already treated, let's say, 30 today, and we're going to the next half here for the afternoon.
What have you mostly treated so far?
Everything. I mean, really, it's been STDs, parasitical infections, cut infections, eye infections, lots of high blood pressure, which really surprised me. Hypertension, tons of it. We have hepatitis A, B, and C that we've taken some people to the hospital, admitted them, and provided dollars for medicine and follow-up treatment. It seems that most of these people just don't have access to any medical care. I mean, they just, even when you go to the hospital, like I said, the closest one, there's no medical supplies, there's nothing in it. There's just beds there. Hi, do you want the doctor? Or you want to see Mama?
It turns out Tyler Belgrave is from Canada, the South Alberta Institute of Technology, where he runs training programs for First Nations students in the energy sector, seems unfathomably far from this makeshift clinic. But for Tyler, the trip from Calgary was a single leap, inspired by a brief encounter with a young girl during his first visit here.
She was 5 years old, and I went to shake her hand, and she put her hand out to me, and then she pulled it away really fast, and I thought she was scared. And this was after days and days of seeing children with really infected cuts. And I saw she had these two cuts that had gone terribly wrong on her hand, so her hand was just tender and sore, and that's why she pulled it back. You know, you have one of those moments where you then suddenly look in her in the eye, and you're thinking, this is just plain wrong. Little kids were, you know, back where I'm from anyways, put some polysporin, clean it up, boom. But the kids here where they get cuts, and they jump in the river, and then they're very dirty, and then infection, infection, infection. Suddenly now they can't use their hands for 12, 13, 14 months until it heals, if it heals right. So just took my own money and put it together. The whole mission probably itself cost about $22,000.
That was enough to cover the team's flights from Canada, lodging, medical supplies, and a driver for a rented SUV, or Cat-Cat, a four-wheel drive. This is their fifth village.
The first day we had a lot of disorder as we were just sort of learning this, as we're all new to this. I mean, it was pandemonium because everybody wanted to watch and everybody got so close. It was complete chaos. So we've sort of gotten it down now to a bit more of a science. As you see, it's orderly, and the doctor can spend time with each patient.
And this is completely voluntary?
100%.
Wells and schools built by various tourist associations are not uncommon in the Dogon country. But drive-by healthcare? That's new around here.
So this is the LPN here, so she's seeing some
of
the
Arnie Lee. And you're from Canada too?
Yeah, from Calgary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. It's my first time in Mali, my second time in Africa. Wow. Treating a lot of parasites here. I see a lot of wounds in children mostly. A lot of fungal infections on the head and various other parts of the skin, things like that. A lot of stomach bloating in children, which is often a common of parasites. So we're treating that.
The question that nags at me, though, is what happens when you leave?
I know. That's tough.
It's too late to save all the rotting teeth she's seen today, but Marnie Lee Jensen thinks a little prevention here could go a long way, giving out toothbrushes, for instance.
One more and then lunch.
Then I'm told the Canadians' permits aren't quite in order, so no more recording, please. Come back in the afternoon, Tyler says, and we'll take it from there. But by the time I return for the rest of the story, which I've nicknamed Doctors Without Papers, Tyler has a different look on his face. We have to respect local sensibilities, he says solemnly. And the Malian doctor traveling with us would rather we didn't talk to you anymore. Sorry. Goodbye. And just like that, the story evaporates in the broiling heat, along with whatever I thought I understood about survival in the Dogon country. After over a dozen trips to this continent, I had no illusions about hardship in Africa. I'd just taken all the smiles here at face value, without grasping how much suffering lay behind them. My guide and I take a walk to the Turgina, the Dogon version of a town council, with a roof just a few feet off the ground. It's designed that way for conflict prevention. When people have an issue to settle, they talk it out. Nothing can escalate as long as they're sitting down. And that's where we find Yurgima, the village elder I'd been looking for.
Uh-huh.
He's sitting alone in the shade with a yellow and black crocheted cap on his shaved head, a knife and four smooth leather satchels tied around his loose black trousers, and a silver hoop in each pierced ear. Just above his knee is a cow's tail to shoo the bugs away. And he's smoking the same long pipe I remember from last time.
Hey, I love that.
Yurgima's turning 102 this year, and he says three other villagers are even older. He has 25 children between two wives. He worked every single day since the age of 12 for more than 80 years. His vision is failing now, he says, so he can't weave cotton, rope, or mats anymore. But otherwise, no complaints.
Oh, wonderful smell of this tobacco that he puts in his pipe, the flowers. Fait du bien?
He says work is a treasure, part of his secret to a long life. Washed down, he adds, with plenty of millet beer. Yergima sends me off with a bounty of blessings. But I leave the next morning with a sense of incompletion, riding the 100 or so kilometers back to Mopti. One of Tyler Belgrave's comments keeps playing in my mind.
You see something wrong, you can do something about it, or you can just pretend you never saw it, right? So just kind of pulling my heartstrings.
Now, everything revealed by Tyler's gesture was pulling on my heartstrings. But I had to leave it there. My trek was over, and my visit to Mali was drawing to a close. Then again, sometimes when you let things go, they come back. 2 days later, while sipping a cool drink on the breezy terrace of Hotel Y'a Pas de Problème, or Hotel No Problem, voila, in walk the three Canadians, as if they were right on cue in a fancy meeting you hear scene from a Woody Allen film. Turns out there was nothing wrong with their paperwork. The local doctor just didn't trust Ana Saras with microphones. The mission complete, they're free to talk now.
I honestly did not think that we would be facing these kind of challenges that we did when we went to each village.
The good doctor Mirna Nahas, who lives in Calgary, spent her childhood in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley and thought she had an idea what to expect on this trip. That wasn't the case.
Remember, these are people who have not seen a physician all their lives. And then all of a sudden they come to us and, oh wow, this is something really serious that needs to be addressed. The strokes, the super bad infections that we've seen that have been, you know, brewing for such a long time, that this is part of their lives. They live with it. That's normal to them, but it's not normal to us.
Dr. Nahas had decided on her profession when she was a young girl in Lebanon with one clear wish.
I want to have a day where I open the clinic and don't take money from anybody. I just be helping people. So when Tyler approached me with his project, it was like my dream coming true. This is my way of giving back. So here I am.
Tyler Belgrave is keen to raise funds and do this again. Long-term development schemes might make a positive difference down the line, but he wants to help right now.
From what I've seen through Dr. Nahas, there's a ton of doctors who would love to do this. People want to help. They want to do good work. But again, they can't just take off for 6 months from their jobs, right? They have patients, right, that they need to obviously see that rely on them too and that they're responsible to. So you could start a program where doctors, right, who would still reside in their home country could spend 2 weeks helping others but still keep their jobs, if you will, back in Canada. Something in between Doctors Without Borders. Okay, doctors with borders, but sometimes without borders.
In the Dogon country, good health, good company, and a good meal are reason enough to sing and give thanks. The next time Tyler arrives with Doctors Between Borders, they'll be greeted with songs of gratitude. And so will the rest of us, the Anasaras with rucksacks from the world beyond these cliffs. For Dispatches, I'm Alexa Divorson in the middle of Mali.
And a postscript to that story, Tyler Belgrave has since formed a partnership with SOS Children's Villages. He's raising funds to build a medical clinic and train medical staff in Mali's Dogon region. That's our podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. You can download it every Thursday from the web, where we also keep all our past programs, cbc.ca/dispatches. You can also hear us on the National Radio Network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. We're on Radio 1 Thursday at 1 p.m., with an encore Sunday evening at 7 after the news. This program is the work of producers Donna Dingwall and Allison Maceman and Steve McNally, with technical producer Victor Johnston, senior producer Alan Gattell, and myself. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. You have just heard Dispatches. We'll bring you the world.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.